You are listening to How Do We Make It Better, the podcast where we explore how people in nonprofits, corporations, social enterprises, politics, and other walks of life try to make it better. Get this where all quality podcasts are found. Links to all those places are at bit.ly/How Do We Make It Better Podcast, or if that's too long, bit.ly/HDWMIB. You can also check us out at dougabdiel.com. That's dougabdiel.com. Today, I recorded a podcast with Zurbin Singleton. I've had him on this program once before. Fellow Marine major, went to the basic school together nearly 13 years ago now. And just an amazing man who's overcome a great deal of adversity. African-American, but on the Naval Academy football team, was the only guy who outran me on the O course at the basic school. Brilliant aeronautical engineer, and also, like I said, a man of color who grew up in Georgia in part. Look, I must admit at the beginning of this podcast that I'm just waking up to some of the troubles that some of my fellow Marine officers even had to deal with racism in America. I thought largely that this was an issue that was consigned to history. And like many others, through recent events, through recent videos, I've had a second look. And I hope that you'll just join me listening to first one of Zurbin's experiences about this, his own disproportionately suspicious treatment, or the suspicious treatment that he was giving, and then the conversation that we had that follows on from that, where he talks about some of the remedies that he thinks through. I didn't can any of these questions. I didn't do a lot of prep work. I hope it's the better for it, for being that genuine and being that considered. I hope as well that, like me, if you don't have this on your radar, if you think it's a issue that is terrible, racism is an issue that's terrible, but is consigned to the dustbin of history, that you'll take the time to have a second look and reconsider. Okay, before we get started in the meat of this conversation, I just wanted to give Zurbin the floor to make racism in America real for everybody. And without further ado, I just want to turn it over to you, Zurbin.
Definitely. One experience that comes to mind, I was moving from Pensacola to California. So I was driving across country. I was in Texas, and I get pulled over. I was dating a young lady, and she was in the car with me as well. Both officers in the military. We get pulled over. They say we were speeding. Then they say we were going like 4 or 5 over. We give them our IDs. We also give them our military. Both officers in the military. I'm black. She's Hispanic. And they like take her out of the car and start questioning her separately. And I'll tell you that being at the academy, the naval law course that we took taught me a lot of things that I didn't know that I had the option to do, that I could refuse them to search my car and different things like that. They couldn't keep me for a certain period of time. And so then they asked me, could they search my car? And I was like, no, sir, I don't have anything in the car. We was just like, we'd be on our way. And they was like, why wouldn't he let us search his car? I was like, well, sir, you can't search my car. You don't have probable cause. And you can see that I'm moving. I have like stuff packed in the back of the car. Questioning me, they're interrogating me. Like, one, we're both officers in the military. So the probability of us doing something illegal that you need to search my car, there's no reason for you to search my car. So they continue to question me. They eventually call a K-9 unit. The K-9 unit, as long as it's not an unreasonable amount of time, and unreasonable amount of time can be questionable. I think we were waiting 30 or 45 minutes while they're questioning me. While really they're just keeping me there so they can get the K-9 unit, bring the K-9 so they can walk around the car, see if I have drugs. I don't have any drugs. There's nothing going on. And then they tell me we've had problems with people trafficking drugs on this highway. Why would you get the indication that I would be that person? I feel like that if I couldn't have stayed calm, I didn't know the law, that situation could have turned a lot different. as we've seen in many cases now, where black men are being shot unreasonably. And I just thank God that that wasn't the case for me in that situation.
And I got to thank you for sharing that. I can't imagine, I have never had a police officer ask to search my car. Never. And I think that's emblematic of exactly the issue that we're talking about. So thank you for sharing that story right up front. And for everybody else, you're here while we set up the podcast and the way we did in a second. But thanks again, Zerb.
Thank you.
Okay. Today, again, my guest is Zerbin Singleton, a friend of mine, a Marine Corps officer, and a very understandably proud black man who has achieved some amazing things and probably solved the square root of pi in his head, given where he went to school and how well he did at the Naval Academy. But it's around that second piece, being an African American in America, that I thought I needed to revisit something with Zerbin. And look, I did a podcast a couple of years ago that, to be honest with you, I look back and it was just after Charlottesville. And I'm leaving it up, even though I'm ashamed of it, because I want to be clear that like growth can happen. And what I thought was a relatively understanding conversation where I came out and said, look, this is whatever it was, 2018. I shouldn't have to say it, but racism has no part in America and the Tiki Torch Brigade shouldn't define what it is to be an American. And I clearly thought that after Charlottesville, after some of the things that we saw there, after Black Lives Matter starting in that era, that we were pretty well, this was a dying issue, that this was not something that was real today. And oh man, like Freddie Gray came out and just hearing some of the stories of pillars of our community talking about traffic stops and where they need to have their hands, I felt compelled personally to educate myself because I was ignorant about this topic. And I was just having a conversation with Zerbin not very long before. This is as close to just a real off-the-cuff conversation as you can get. Unlike most of my other interviews where we've got a structured question list that I like to go down and I pre-record it with the interviewees, I felt like it was really almost inappropriate of me in the context of this type of interview to frame the interview up in that way. So Zerbin and I went through just a couple of things that were important to him. And really, I want to give him a platform to talk about his experience, to give his prescriptions for how we might all make it better in this regard. And to talk through perhaps some of the vignettes in his life that I should understand as a white guy who grew up in Wisconsin, who went to school in the South and thought that, you know, look, after Jim Crow and Martin Luther King Jr., and certainly after Charlottesville, that we had this done and dusted. Look, thanks for joining me, Zerbin. I don't even know where to start the questions. Could maybe you just be prescriptive to me as somebody who is in that position, who's an ignorant white guy from the Midwest who thought this was all done and dusted? What would you say to somebody like me? Or can you please tell me, what is it that I need to know about what it is like to be a black man in America today?
Yeah, definitely, Doug. And I just want to thank you for having me on your podcast again. It's always a pleasure. And just to give my opinion and talk about things that are really affecting America now. I can give you a perspective, say that I began my life growing up in Alaska. I grew up with my black side of the family, and most of the everywhere I went was white. I went to predominantly white school and things like that. And then when I moved to Georgia, I went to an all-black school. And things that I had seen on TV that really affected, that I thought that really represented segregation or racism, such as the Confederate flag, which was still Georgia's main flag, really affected. I was like, man, like this is prevalent in society still. I see this, and the first thing I think is it's racism and segregation, because to me, that's what it represented. And so you or somebody from Wisconsin or something might see that flag or see the Confederate flag, and it doesn't have that same effect, even in history. So growing up, you don't, and it may have changed some now, but growing up, you don't learn about black history and all the African-American history and all the contributions that African-Americans made to history and building America and different things like that, and some of the atrocities that they suffered, but they continue to overcome and continue to help make America what it is today. And that's completely left out of history. And the way that I learned that, very small amount in school, but reading books, my parents teaching, and just my yearn to learning and learning more about history and the contributions we made. A lot of that stuff just gets left out. And so growing up as African American, you feel like you're left out, and that maybe the average white man or just doesn't recognize it, doesn't know about it. One, because they weren't taught and it's not how they were brought up. But two, they have a bias that they don't know about. One, because of ways that African Americans are portrayed on TV, whether it's through the news or TV shows or different things like that. And overall, I think that the atmosphere of the country and the history and everything combined together, I want to say difficult, but as a white person or average white person, you don't have that yearning to learn more about everybody around you because it doesn't seem to you that it's needed.
Look, I'm conscious that lots of people, myself included, learn through analogies. I guess I'd love to know, is there another analogy, perhaps not from racism? Like, what does it feel like? Is there anything similar to the feeling that you got when you moved to Georgia and saw the stars and bars flying there proudly, just as I did in South Carolina, where I was like, what is this all about still? Really? We're still flying this thing? I shouldn't say just like me. It wasn't just like me because it wasn't the same experience for you. Is there anything that the rest, white America, could to use as a mental analogy for just how confronting that experience is? Is there something that's like that could make it real to us?
I would say, I think we can all agree that the Civil War was about slavery. It was economically how the South thrived and survived. And it was a war where that side lost, but everybody, all their generals, all the events, they have monuments and different things like that that are still celebrated. So let's think about when Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. And they talk about, I can't remember the admiral's name, Japanese fleet, brilliant mind.
Yamamoto, right?
Yeah.
Yamamoto?
Yeah, I think Admiral Yamamoto was one of them. He was a brilliant mind, a great tactician. That was a critical event in the war. But after the war, we didn't put statues of him up. We didn't celebrate him and do different things like that. We may study it because as somebody who's in the military or somebody that loves history, you want to learn, how did he do that? How can I learn from what he did, his mistakes, his achievements, so that I can be a better tactician in the art of war? You're not going to go anywhere in America and see a statue of that man. You're not going to see anything like that. But all over America, there's statues of Confederate generals, soldiers, events, things that to us is celebrating slavery and what kept us down and a lot of the thoughts and perceptions that people have against African Americans.
Look, that brings it home a little bit more to me as a, you know, white guy. We had little war memorials in the town where I grew up to the guys that we lost in World War II. And the notion that we would put a statue of Admiral Yamamoto right next to him, the date that will live in infamy is what FDR said about it, is just, that's galling to me. It doesn't speak to the sacrifice that those Americans had to go through to literally fight a war, to talk about, in that instance, again, racism in the context of the Nazis in Europe. Is that enough? Is that a good enough analogy? Or is there something else? Is there something deeper? Is that even close to that same kind of feeling for you? Or is there something, is it even deeper than that?
I think it's definitely deeper than that. I just think that's a great analogy. Like, you want to, it's not something, not a way that you would celebrate an enemy. And to African Americans, that was the enemy of our livelihood, how we lived. And even had the history, still the history of African Americans fighting in the Civil War, fighting in World War I, World War II, and the segregation that they faced. And that they would fight, thinking fighting for America or a country that doesn't love you, doesn't want you, you're a second-class citizen, but you're still out there fighting for your country. Just trying to prove some of those men, even women, were just trying to prove their war worth. And so that, one, that they're equal, there's nothing different between a white man and a black man. And even from during World War I for blood transfusions, that it was believed that you couldn't, like a black man couldn't give a white man blood because their blood was contaminated.
That's just amazing to me. I guess this component, just to support one thing that Zurbin said, I should say Major Singleton as well, talks about the history of this. I think for those of you out there who do not believe that the Civil War was in fact about slavery, I think you should go back and read the secession statements for Mississippi, for the states that seceded at the beginning. And some of them actually cite slavery. It's not just state rights to do whatever they want. It is states' rights to enslave other human beings who they looked on as subhuman. And any reasonable reading of those secession statements will tell you that's what exactly Zurbin is talking about is absolutely true. To this point about, look, not allowing blood transfusions, not accepting the contributions that African Americans have had to America, I guess I'd love to know some specific things that you're talking about, but I'd love to know also, like, what would be your recommendation around, especially those of us who are now adults in life, we're not pushed through this education system anymore. What can we do? I can say from my perspective, George Washington Carver, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King Jr., and W.E.B. Du Bois, that was probably the compendium of powerful black figures that I learned about growing up. Beyond that, and I think probably those latter two, W.E.B. Du Bois and George Washington Carver, probably didn't make a strong showing in lots of other people's history classes to begin with. Possibly Frederick Douglass as well. I guess two questions for you. One, what are the things that we've overlooked that are really important to you? And two, if we do want to learn more about those, like, what have you found compelling? What is elevating, what's worthwhile and uplifting for you to read that you would commend to others?
I think you should just take a topic that you like or an area that you like and just search African-American history in that area because it's something that's going to appeal to you. And I promise you, when you, if it's science, if it's math, if it's sports, if you just search that topic in African-American history, I think it will just leave a profound thought on your mind that, man, I didn't know about this. I didn't know this existed. I didn't know that this was just even happened. Like, for instance, Dr. Charles Drew, during World War II, he revolutionized blood transfusions, storage techniques and everything. I mean, he saved countless numbers of lives. And he was one of the reasons, he was one of the persons that proved that you can mix black people's blood with white people's blood. And that's just one example. I love science and I love math. So I've studied men of color, women of color in those areas a lot. But I said, just take something that you're interested in and just research that area. And I think it'll help expand your mind. And I know we're talking a lot about history and from Jim Crow, and we haven't got to Jim Crow yet, but slavery and stuff. And people are like, I wasn't around back then. Why should I be held accountable for that? And you may not need to be held accountable for that, but you got to be held accountable for your mind. And a lot of things, a lot of perceptions that you have, a lot of racial biases that you have may even be unknown because you refuse to recognize it or think that it's not a problem. But as a man thinketh, a man does. And if you have these biases against African Americans that they're not equal to you, they can't do as good as a job, different things like that, you're going to treat people that way, maybe even unknowingly. So the first step is recognizing that you may have a bias in your mind and in your thought frame that prevents you from seeing racial tendencies that you might have.
Look, I think I'm a victim of this bias, and it's only been recently brought to my attention that clearly this is not done in America. I think from my perspective, one of the ones that I clearly held was, look, this is largely an issue that's gone. in America. It exists inside of pockets, and we should deal with it in pockets, much like us in the Marine Corps, Urban. Like, you know, we're dark green Marines, light green Marines, but we're all Marines, right? It doesn't matter where you came from in America or what the color of your skin is in America. We're all Americans. And I thought these were issues that were solved. What do you say to those people who are just like, oh, look, it's just not, slavery was terrible. Jim Crow was terrible. Glad that Martin Luther King Jr. came and did his important work, but we've moved on from that. That's not a big issue anymore. What do you say to, or what is your response to that sentiment? A sentiment that, honestly, I probably held more than a couple of years ago, where I was like, look, I thought largely this was not an issue that was as pressing as overall health outcomes in America, or as national defense, or as something else. This is a real, what do you say to people who recognize it, say it's a thing, say it's a bad thing, but they just don't think it exists anymore?
I would ask, Doug, I would ask you this. Have you ever been the only white person in a room?
Probably not since I've been in, went down to Haiti, actually. It depends if you want to count Afghanistan. I suppose occasionally I was, but that, those are probably the only times in my life, you're right, where I was the only white guy in a room.
And how did it make you feel?
Well, look, I mean,
it's different when you're in a different country. If you're in Afghanistan, then you're expecting everybody around you to be Afghani. If you're in Haiti, you're expecting to be surrounded by Haitians. But when you're not Australia now, but when you were in America, has you ever been in a room where you were the only white person?
I'm trying to think back, and not in a room of any size. I got to be honest with you. I think, to be honest with you, probably the closest I ever got was when I was on the track team at the Citadel, and a large proportion of the track team were African-American men who could run like the way they were great. They were amazing athletes, phenomenal. And they outnumbered us white guys by a large proportion. And there were probably instances I know there were instances in that locker room context where I was the only white guy there. I wasn't the only white guy on the team. In maybe 6-7 of us or something like that, I might have been the only white guy for a little bit, but that's not a very big group. You know, like, that's actually a galling thing to think about, actually, that's probably the biggest group of just African American men that I've ever been with at one time. And I guess to your question, how did it make me feel at the time? Look, at that time, you'd horse around like you did on the track team. Everybody was puffing out their chest saying how awesome they were anyways. It was a unique experience being in college athletics, as you would know. But I suppose for me, maybe it was the fact that the room was relatively small still, and that in retrospect, maybe that's an amazing thing. That's probably the largest collection of African-American I've ever been with. I can't imagine, or I didn't feel at that time like the other or ostracized, but it could be because that room is small. Is that what you're trying to get me to think?
A little bit. And on a team, you probably wouldn't feel that as much, because as a team, you build bonds. You have those commonalities, and you've sweat together, cried together, bled together. So you've already built that bond. But if you went, so your time in the military, if you think about how many black officers were around you, and just think about the environment they were in. And when they step in that environment, a lot of times you're wondering, does my boss see me as a, and actually not just in the military, but in any type of employment, any job, when a black man or black woman steps into, they have their boss, does that person see me as the highly talented, educated person for this job, or do they see me as a black man? Am I going to be viewed the same as my white counterparts? Am I going to get the same raises? Are they going to recognize my talent just as they would equally to a white person? And for us growing up, we always felt that we always feel that we have to work twice as hard to look even as the next white person.
I guess I'd like to highlight two things. One, and something I forgot just a minute ago, and I don't want to edit it out. You heard some background noise where Zurbin is, and that's because he's actually downrange fighting for his country right now, or prepared to. So some of those aircraft you hear in the background are actually warbirds. And I guess I would love to hear from you how you deal with those situations and how you would like white guys like me, the rest of the dominant culture in the globe, to deal with those situations as well. Is this dark green Marine approach that we took in the Marine Corps, or we take in the Marine Corps, is that working? It kind of half acknowledges it, but says, hey, the important thing is that we're all Marines. You're dark green, I'm light green, but we're all Marines. Is that useful? Is it useful in that situation to say, hey, look, I realize you might have just taken charge of a helo section here, and you're the only black man there. Like, you're the CO, you're the lead, but that might present some challenges for you. What is it that you would recommend in those situations to make it better?
I'll probably say that probably the majority of those in the Marine Corps do see the Marine green. But I think it's unfair to say that everybody sees that. And I think you can see that just in the statistics in the military, as far as promotions, the representation of African Americans and the officer rates. I think the Marine Corps is one of the lowest. The statistics of them going to command, the professional knowledge that they're not taught because maybe they're not in the in group that prevents them from reaching some of those heights. And it's all in the statistics. And I believe that all branches of the military are striving to improve that. And man, it really hit home when the Marine Corps started to ban the Confederate flag. And it was the first branch to do, because the Marine Corps was the last branch to desegregate. It also has the least percentage of African-American officers of the other branches too, as a percentage-wise. So when people say that all Marines just see Marine green, that's another bias that I believe is untrue. And when you say that and don't recognize that there is a racial bias in all of the branches, that you're perpetuating that there's not a problem when there is.
Look, just for those who aren't on the inside and aren't completely up on what our commandant is doing, what Zurbin's talking about happened just a couple months ago. This isn't like long history. He just came out a couple months ago and said, hey, this is prejudicial to good order and discipline. This doesn't represent the spirit of the Corps that we want. This is an ancient history. And I guess to bounce off one thing that you said there, I heard and I'm going to butcher the quote, but I was just listening to This American Life a couple days ago, and a poet apparently was quoted as saying, there is nothing more discriminatory it is as discriminatory to treat two people who are different the same as it is to treat two people who are the same differently, which I think speaks to your point about, hey, look, all Marines are green, right? Let's move to this post-racial world where this doesn't matter. This isn't something that we dealt with. And I got to be honest with you, that was the world that I thought I was residing in, that this was an issue that, again, we had stamped out, we had put down, like we literally fought a war over it. We literally, like, we had the freaking 14th Amendment. We had Martin Luther King Jr. march in Selma, and we had sit-ins before you and I were born. And I thought we were in this post-racial world. For God's sake, we had a black president, right? This is great. We might not have everything stamped out, but certainly this is the direction that we're going. And I would love to know from your perspective, what are these persistent patterns of segregation that you see that are perhaps somehow I thought I was relatively educated. Lived most of my life in America, with the exception of a few tours here and there, that are clearly transparent to me, or at least not ones that I see. Like, what are these persistent patterns of segregation that make it tone deaf for people like me to say, hey, look, this is not an issue for today?
I would say that racism can be even more scarier today, because back in the day, you knew who was racist, and they overtly showed it. Today, a lot of people that know they're racist, they hide it, which can make it even worse. And then today, a lot of things that we're seeing isn't new. It's just that they're being videotaped. This stuff has been happening, but when it's a black man's word versus a white man's word, and that man may be a police officer or a person of authority, naturally they're going to take that person's word over the others, or that person's dead and cannot talk, or they're not going to listen to the witnesses because maybe they were black. And so a lot of stuff is coming to light now because it's being videotaped. There's proof that it's happening. And it's not something that's new. And so I think it's helping America and around the world recognize that it's still a problem. Things that we've been fighting for years, like you said, that you thought there wasn't a problem, it's still a problem, and it's still prevalent. And it's sad. And I believe a lot of this has to do with education, people having open minds to change the way they think. And it has to begin in the schools as early as elementary, when kids are learning about history, so that they don't have some of the biases that are built into them, TV, sometimes through their parents, through things that they see, through music, different things like that. And that is going to help build the change, as well as a lot of the policies that we have today, like even redlining. Still goes on today. People getting denied for mortgages still goes on today because of their race. Not because they don't have the credit score, or they don't have the equity or what they need for their loan. They're denied because of their race. Same thing with jobs, benefits. It needs a transformation, but it has to be done.
I guess for those of us who are sympathetic to this, okay, my mind certainly has been opened a little bit more on social media, seeing these videos saying, oh my, again, like, man runs down the street, two men with shotguns in a pickup truck tell him to stop. He keeps running, he gets shot. And yet the prosecutor is like, oh, nope, didn't, that was self-defense. What in the... If that had happened in reverse, right? That was two black guys in a truck with shotguns and a white guy, like, I would have kept running too, right? Like, this, for those of us who've been woken up by some of the videos that you're talking about in this kind of persistent age of a lot of these, what can we do, sir? Like, what I've got a small platform here. I've got, you know, a few dedicated subscribers and God knows how many through syndication, but what on earth, what would you prescribe for the rest of us? Like, how can we help? Some of us, now that we've been a little bit woken up, feel like, all right, this is an issue. Where do we go from here?
It has to start both at the top and the bottom. At the top, it has to start with the leadership, and it has to start organizations. So if we talk about the police, I had an uncle that was a police officer. Growing up, I wanted to be a police officer. And there's lots of great police officers out there. But there's police officers and there's groups of police officers that aren't upholding the standard that they're supposed to. And they're not being held accountable. And some of the people, and some of that's perpetuated from the top, from the leadership, in those police departments. I feel like these kinds of organizations have to, they all have to be taken a look at, because it's, I can't say that this police department is bad, this police department is good. I don't know. But we have to take a fine tooth comb and root out the bad ones and keep the good ones and continue to have training that teaches you how to properly de-escalate situations. When you come to a situation, you're not necessarily judging somebody because of the color of their skin, which is going to make you react different in that situation. So I have a friend that's a teacher on the East Coast, and I was like, what are y'all going to do about schools? And she was like, well, schools have to open for the economy to open back up. Because if schools aren't open, parents have to stay home to watch their kids. But people, as they've already said, that COVID affects minorities at a greater proportion than whites. When schools open back up, most minorities go to schools that are overcrowded and overpopulated. The schools are not funded. They have less teachers. They have less space. They have more students, which is going to increase them of having being exposed and being carriers of COVID. A lot of minority families, a lot of African-American families live in households with their combined households because of financial circumstances. And when they go home, there's a lot of elderly people in their home. So now your kids are bringing back COVID, which maybe aren't affecting the kids. But now they're bringing it back to their elderly parents or grandparents. And so it's going to disproportionately affect the African-American community. And this is just one way that maybe in a white man or in a white society is not something you think of, because unless you're, and now this isn't the case for all white people in poverty who's going to be affected the same way, because a lot of our school districts, the good school districts, are because of property taxes. And if you're more affluent, then you're going to have better schools because that pays for your school. But if you're in a poor neighborhood, then your schools aren't good. They aren't properly funded. And so you get a worse education and things like that. And so that's just one way that particularly African-Americans and others who are in poor areas are going to be affected when schools start opening back up and the economy starts opening back up.
I think this notion of overlapping issues that aren't easily disentangled, I think for me, this is one of the things that, as a classic liberal, not liberal in like the left sense of politics, but liberal in the sense of like Locke and look, each person has individual rights, like Western liberal, like we're talking about individuals here. Let's just talk about what you individually did with your life or what you individually were able to achieve. This kind of classic American equality of opportunity that we all talk about and aspire to. I think what you're illustrating is that this really, it isn't reality in the world, that there are these overlapping issues of entrenched poverty, of being redlined and pushed into the same district. The same district might not have the same tax base, and thus you have poorer schools, and thus you have bigger class sizes, and thus you have higher COVID effects. And like all these things compound each other, and you end up in a spot where you have over time too many disadvantages for one individual to be an amazing super, unless they're like you. And to be honest with you, like serving you and me, you were the only guy who ever beat me on the obstacle course. And like you, I still remember that. Like you were crazy smart, obviously. I think it was aeronautical engineering at the Naval Academy. And I didn't even get into the Naval Academy. I got some nominations, but I didn't have perfect color vision. And I couldn't do what you do, literally. Like I don't have the color vision to fly. And you are, by any stretch of the imagination, several orders of magnitude or several standard deviations of the mean above the average human being. And it's quite amazing to me what you've been able to make it through, given some of the compounding issues that I know you have faced and you talked about in your original podcast. I guess, what from an individual basis can we do? And I'm talking primarily to middle America, white folks like me, West Coast America, my fellow Googlers who I know who are listening to this. How can we affect a situation like that with so many compounding layers of disadvantage, where you've got a young kid, you would love to set him on this ideal of American equal opportunity, but for all the reasons that you just talked about in that very specific scenario about going back to school in COVID, he isn't going to be able to do it. And maybe he isn't 4 or 5 standard deviations in the mean above the average individual like you are, and can't just do that classic Horatio Alger American story where you just grab yourself up by the bootstraps and pull yourself out. Like, he just doesn't have any bootstraps left, like Martin Luther King Jr. was saying. Like, how can we inject ourselves positively in that situation? Or maybe there isn't. What can we do to make that better?
I think first you have to look into yourself and recognize that you may have a racial bias that you might not know. And once you figure that out, you have to hold other people accountable. You can't look the other way when things are happening, when things aren't right, when you question things that are going on. Also goes with like the policies and the politicians and people in power and who you vote for and what they actually believe in and the actions they are taking to achieve change. I believe we're all put on earth by God for a purpose. And one of those purposes, no matter what your main purpose is, to help out your fellow man, help out your neighbor. And so I challenge you to ask yourself, how are you helping out your fellow man? How are you helping out your neighbor? What is something that you can do? Find something that you're passionate about, that you can help somebody that is of lesser, whether it's because financially, because maybe they don't have the same opportunities, maybe job opportunities, maybe a lot of it just deals with knowledge and being ignorant or uneducated in certain areas. I was fortunate that my extended family, my parents, told me that I can go to college and do things like that. And there's a lot of people, you have kids, a lot of kids that have parents that have never been to college. And they might not present that option to those kids. And if all your parents know is man, they've lived in poverty all their life, their parents lived in poverty all their life, they don't have the financial literacy to get out of poverty. Or even the education or different things like that, then it's not something that they may teach to their kids. And if your kids are going to schools where they're not teaching this kind of stuff, they're not getting the attention they need to actually learn, then it's just perpetuating the cycle and nothing's really changing. And then when people hide racism, and a lot of people, like you said, you didn't think this was still a problem, and it looks like there's no problem. And it's difficult for the minority to solve, to affect change. Well, to solve by themselves a problem that's affecting them. Like, if only black people were expressing that Black Lives Matter. And when I say, I had a quote, I said that the only reason we say the difference between Black Lives Matter and All Lives Matter is in that many people's version of All Lives Matter, it doesn't encompass Black Lives. So when we say Black Lives Matter, it's to remind everybody that Black Lives are included in the All Lives Matter, because many times they're excluded. And sometimes it's even to remind ourselves that we matter because we've been excluded so many times and left out. And in society that we've seen it, even though it may not be seen by the rest of society, how we've been left out. So one is you have to recognize that there is a problem. And when you recognize there's a problem, if you're not part of the solution, then you're part of the problem. So what are you doing to change? So if you know that education is a problem and you're an educator or you have a passion for education, what's something that you can do to change education for those? If there's a problem with the policies and law that disproportionately affect minorities through conviction rates, through judges, through laws that continue to keep them down and make it hard for them to get out the situation they're in, and you're passionate about law, you go to your passion and work on that change. If you're passionate about helping people in poverty, what can you do to help those people in poverty? What's something that you can do to help them get out of poverty? And it's not, and a lot of people talk about social programs and different things like that. Why do I pay taxes to help these people or help somebody? They grew up just like me, or they can do it by themselves and things like that. I think social programs that we have today or another problem. A social problem should be designed to help people out at a disadvantage, but enable them to not need those programs anymore and bring them to a level and plane where they don't need those programs anymore. And unfortunately, that's not the case. I believe some of that is tied to money, that if I talked about the private prison systems, think about people make money by people being in their jails. So if I own a prison and my goal is to make money, the only way I make money is if I keep people in prison or increase the amount of people in my prison, what's the incentive for me to not have people go to prison? I lose money. And different social programs are designed like that too. If I make money because this person stays on welfare all their life, what's my incentive to get them off welfare? If I get them off welfare, or if I get them off this social program, then I'm losing money. A lot of systems in our society are set up backwards. They're not set up to help people. They're set up as a permanent crutch, keep them in the position they have so that I can continue making money instead of helping them out, enable them, bring them up to a leveling plane so that they can reach even higher heights.
How do you feel about this idea of the white savior that comes in? Oh, I'm benevolent, and here I'm going to help this poor, starving African-American child here in the city. I'm going to go and give to World Vision, and that will help some poor, starving black kid on the other side of the world or something like that. And, oh, that's it. I've done my white savior bit. I guess my personal concern about that is that it does become, for most people, they don't actually work in the fields that you're talking about. Most people don't work in education or law or directly in poverty alleviation. Most Americans, we're a consumer society, right? Most Americans buy buck charter or truck barter and exchange basic small consumer goods at McDonald's and at Walmart, and they do their own little jobs in and out. And they might take a little bit of time to donate a little bit of money or donate a little bit of time. And then let's dust our hands and move on. Are you a little bit concerned, like I am, about this kind of tokenish giving or this tokenish action, which doesn't really change people's hearts and thus their overall approach. Is that an unwarranted concern? I don't know. Maybe I'm just projecting.
I think that can be a concern. And if people are just in the way that you stated that, if people are doing it like the way you stated it, if they're not humble and their heart's not right, then the people they're helping are going to see that. A lot of problems take money to solve. So if you're giving money, if your heart's not right and you're not humble about it, it's still going to help somebody, but it's not going to have the effect that you could have. So it takes humbling, and your heart has to be in the right place. If it's not, then it could make things even worse.
It seems like you have a real passion for giving where you are, though, like finding a way to become a person of integrity. And if this is really what you believe, then act it where you are, wherever that might be, in that Walmart or in that, you know, local diner or in your local whatever, where most people interact. I guess what I'm a little concerned about, again, as a white guy from Wisconsin who thought it was novel to have two African American women in his high school, like that was novel. And they left, by the way. Like, how do you give where you live if where you live is a white enclave? How does that work?
I promise you, not probably not too far from you, there's a neighborhood or there's a community or there's a school that you can help that's not all white. I guess maybe if you're I'm sure there's pockets in Wisconsin or like Minnesota. Like I had a friend that's a pilot, and I kind of remember the situation, but it was something going on in the news that was dealing with racism, and he genuinely concerned. He said, "Does this really happen? Does this really happen? Have you ever experienced this?" And he grew up in Minnesota. Probably never had really been around black people, and he never even thought that it could be a problem. He never even thought that it was real, because he never seen it, didn't really know anybody that experienced it. So I would say go somewhere that you wouldn't usually go, somewhere that you'll be uncomfortable. I can't remember if I talked about it in our last podcast, but Pastor Miles McPherson, he wrote a book called The Third Option. And it goes beyond the option of black and white. And I would say you don't have to be religious or a Christian to read this book. But it's about your heart. It talks about the racist bias that you have. And this book will help you understand that, hey, I might have a racist bias, and what can I do to overcome that racist bias? Try going to an all-black church. And it's probably going to feel very uncomfortable at first. Or go to something that's all black, where you'll be the only white person there in a community, like a rec center or something, help out. If you could be in the consumer market, but maybe you love kids. Big Brother, Big Sister program. I love that program. And most of that program is filled with minorities. And they never have enough brothers to go in and big brothers to go in and make a difference. And I always talk about education, because I always talk about if you can help somebody when they're young, it can change the outcome of their life. And just by touching that one person, you can touch so many.
You know, you just sparked a memory in me that I think the largest, the time where I was the only white guy in a group full of African-American people, it actually probably happened twice. I wasn't the only white guy in one, and I was the only white guy in another. One was going to an Assemblies of God church in Atlanta. The only other white guy in the church was the pastor. And another one was on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., just down the road from where I was living on 2nd and Constitution when I was working for the congressman. On a Sunday, I went out to an African-American church on that Sunday. And to your point earlier about, man, do I feel out of place? Am I all of a sudden, do I realize that I am a white guy here? Man, did I realize that I was a white guy? But to that church's amazing credit, they didn't treat me. They were just so happy to have somebody new walking in the door. They were so happy to have somebody coming in, and they didn't care. They were happy. They weren't going to change the way they worship. They weren't going to change the way that they work. And that was right downtown in Washington, D.C. And Lord knows you go across the river to Anacostia and you wouldn't have any trouble. And I think I have to, that challenge that you had really resounds with me. The times in my life where I have made myself a little bit uncomfortable, stepped out, even if I didn't intend to. In those cases, I was just looking for a local church to go to. Nowhere in the Bible does it say that God only died for Jewish people, right? Semitic people, let alone white people or black people, right? Like, you want to talk about omitted. White people are not really in the Bible. And it's a real encouragement to me to reflect now as you're speaking back on those times, and to encourage myself to step out and do something a little bit differently than I ordinarily do. If I'm comfortable, I'm probably not doing the right thing. I guess we were intending to be a little unstructured here, and I will be for everybody's transparency. If you have time, I guess I would love to ask you at the beginning of this, and we can post it up at the beginning just to try and make sure that people understand your story and where you're coming from. I would love to know from your perspective some of those personal experiences where you're like, look, this is clearly one of those situations where I wish that I had somebody from white powerful class or moneyed class or whatever, you come in and say, hey, look, that's not on, or this is an experience that I personally had about it. I'd love to put that up front if you have time for it. But before we move on to that, is there anything else that you want to say that you think would be really constructive to just add to where people are thinking about this?
I like the quote by Frederick Douglass. He says, it's easier to build strong children than to repair broken men. So definitely, not only begins with children, like black children, begins with white children, how they're brought up. And if you're a kid that's been taught to hate your life, white or black, as you grow up, you continue to harbor that, and it becomes the norm. And so we just have to raise our children up right, raise other children up, and help them understand that it's not the way. Another book that I would recommend by Malcolm Gladwell is his newest book. It's called Talking to Strangers. If you like audiobooks, this is one of my favorite audiobooks to listen to, just because how he tells his stories and examples he gives. But he talks about different encounters over these last couple of years where people judge strangers because of the bias they had, and it made them make incorrect decisions, which a lot of times cause people's lives. It's an excellent book that I encourage you to read. That and The Third Option. I think if you read both of those books, it'll help you understand better the views and the life that a lot of African-Americans live just in the day-to-day walk. And I think it'll help increase your passion to help change the way you think and change the way other people think, and actually take action faith without works is dead.
Amen. Look, I'll put links to both of those books in the show notes. I can also commend the Talking to Strangers book. I think I made it through it in about 8 hours on a flight that I had, a transcontinental flight I had to do. And again, full of these powerful vignettes that make you think a little bit differently. Unless there's anything else, Zurbin, I just want to thank you for your continued service to the country. Thank you for all that you... Zurbin practices what he preaches. He listened to his first podcast, clearly going out, being a mentor, being a role model for young African-American men, outstanding officer. Like, I just can't say enough about you and my thanks for you taking the time. So thanks very much for that, Zurbin.
I guess one more thing, just back to voting. Like even your local, like your senators, your representatives, all the way to the president, to your local city councilmen and the laws that are being passed. I know after George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, who died when the police served a no-knock warrant, they busted her house because they were looking for her ex-boyfriend, who they pretty much guaranteed was there. It was her and her actual boyfriend. And they thought that somebody was breaking in and robbing them. So they shot back and ended up striking the police. She ended up dying. She was an EMT nurse doing what she does. She was there with her boyfriend. Her boyfriend ended up going to jail, and they were going to convict him. They were trying to convict him with attempted murder. Only because after George Floyd, this case started to come up, and it came into the news that he was released from prison. And these are stories that happen all every day. So the reason I talk about voting, because one of the laws that is very controversial is no-knock warrants and how those no-knock warrants actually get approved. And this is just one example of a law that by your vote that you can change. Even like you say, if you're just a consumer, maybe you're not around people, like laws and policies that can be changed if you go to your city council and if you bring up your voice and see how this, again, affects minorities a lot, because a lot of these are happening in minority communities. That her ex-boyfriend, who was supposed to be a drug dealer, hadn't lived there for a while, because whatever evidence that they presented to the judge that was able to get a warrant for a no-knock warrant, and she was killed, and like nobody has faced any ramifications from her death, which was uncalled for. And this is just what's most recently in the news, but it's not something, I would say this happens a lot more than what you hear in the news. A lot more things happen in the news again. Because not that it hasn't been happening, it's just that now it's being videotaped. Or now a voice that can speak upon this comes out more often. But it's not, a lot of these aren't isolated events. They're going all over America, some places all over the world.
Certainly that was my impression growing up. Said, oh, these were isolated incidents, tragic, this kind of stuff, but it wasn't systemic. And I think clearly I was wrong in that. And look, the floor is yours. Is there anything else you wanted to say? Otherwise, again, I'd just like to reiterate my thanks for your time and taking it out. I know you got a busy schedule downrange. Appreciate you doing that.
Definitely. Thank you. Love being on your podcast anytime. Look forward to hearing you.
All right. I want to thank Vasil Skouri for doing all the digital remastery on this track. He's a self-trained audio engineer working out of Europe. He has a collection of extraordinary tracks, both music, wordless, as well as he's done a lot of great producing work for other people. I appreciate him taking his time to clean this up and make it sound like more than just a simple recording between two people. Thanks again, Vasil.